During the introduction by Max, I understood like two words, Azure and phone. And, you know, those two words are kind of interesting because both of those really reflect the need for asynchronous computation today. Like, if you look at Windows Phone, it's based on Silverlight. And if you look at Silverlight, well, nobody likes the UI to be stuck. Nobody likes the application to hang while it's going to the cloud or to a database server or a web service. So in other words, you have to be asynchronous. And indeed, when you try to import, say, a web service proxy, what you get is asynchronous functions. You don't get the synchronous variants anymore because we don't like you to block. Nobody likes to be blocked, right? Secondly, Silverlight itself is asynchronous. The web is asynchronous. You have AJAX programming, like nobody even doubts about it anymore that when you go to Outlook Web Access, well, you get your emails automatically in without doing a whole page refresh. You automatically get updates to the screen. The way that works is by doing asynchronous calls. And indeed, AJAX was originally invented for Outlook Web Access and later became like something that the whole industry sort of took a bet on. And so even in the cloud itself, when we look up here, all of that computation model that you sort of want needs to be non-blocking and asynchronous, because you don't want one part of the cloud to be completely stuck while another part is doing a computation. Those things need to work independently. And so that's where asynchrony actually comes in. Unfortunately, asynchrony is something that's way too hard today. So asynchronous and event-based programming has a lot of, you know, forms in .NET, for example. Like, you have events, you have asynchronous method pairs, you have all that sort of stuff, and it's all different. Like, there's no unification between all those technologies. So it's very hard, I think everyone will agree, and I will show you quite some samples today that show that this is really the case. In every talk, I need to have at least one mathematical formula, so I had to put that in. It's also too hard to compose things. If you have two asynchronous sources, and you want to do something very simple, like having those two things run in parallel, or have them sort of concatenate their results, you have to write lots of glue code. And all of that code is just boring boilerplate code, very error-prone. Like, if one of the sources throws an error, how are you going to prevent from the second source doing something? Like, there's lots of stuff that needs to be done. And so this formula doesn't hold. Like, all those parentheses are really fat. You have to do lots of stuff to make the thing stick together. We just want it to be as lightweight as that little, you know, circle, like the composition. Like, two things composed together is just as simple as having two individual things. That's beautiful. And finally, the way we want to approach this whole asynchronous dragon is by looking through the lenses of observable collections. Everyone knows what a collection is. Everyone understands link. Everyone loves it. You know, you just write a query, and it just magically works. Well, why can't we do that for asynchronous programming as well? Why can't we sort of piggyback on that sort of mechanism that we have in there and reuse that, repurpose that for asynchronous programming? And so that's actually what Rx tries to solve. And we have, you know, a whole set of available downloads on MSDN DevLabs, and we'll actually explain which portions of Rx live where. So Rx is not in .NET 4, even though the two core interfaces, which I will show in just a second, are in the BCL. And I will explain why that is. But so we have downloads for .NET 3.5, .NET 4. We have it for Silverlight. We have it for JavaScript, which is, of course, untyped, so it's a little bit harder to work with, but that's just the way it is. You know, JavaScript is, you know, a library which doesn't really have any typing. And then you have XNA, so we can run on Xbox and Zune, and we also run on Windows Phone, where we are actually in the ROM of the device. So if you buy a Windows Phone, it's kind of pleasing. You know, when I go to bed in the evening, I say, well, in a couple of months, my code will be on every single Windows Phone 7. Beautiful. So let's take a look. I told you that we were actually going to do this whole exercise by means of taking a look at collections. So everyone knows what collections are, and I assume that most people here have written a line of .NET code and have seen this interface. You know, IEnumerable returns, you know, data in some way. That's like what an array inherits from, that's, you know, what a list inherits from, that's what Link2SQL uses, for example. So let's actually take a look at what the problem is with this interface, because we want to sort of contrast synchrony with asynchrony. And so if you look at this interface, it's incredibly pool-based. What does that mean? Well, basically what you're doing here is you're sort of begging the database to get data. You're really sitting on your bare knees and saying, please give me an enumerator. And if the database says, I'm taking a nap, then you're stuck forever. Like, that thing won't return. So it's very blocking, it's very pool-based, it's very synchronous. And similarly, the for each loop in C# actually binds to move next and current. Well, the same thing can happen. You might even not move forward. If the database again is taking a nap, you know, this move next call will say, hey, just wait for me, I won't come back. And you don't get any Boolean back, so you can't make any progress. So if you do that on the UI thread, you have a huge problem. So I won't talk about reset. That's a method that's in there for historical reasons. That's always a good excuse to talk about mistakes. And, you know, this out thing, that's something new in C# 4.0. It's covariance. It actually shows pretty good how the data is flowing. T appears in output positions, which means that you have to get it. You don't get it thrown at you. You have to beg for it and take it out. So that's the way, the direction the data flows and the way you sort of go about retrieving data in this world. So you can get stuck. Like, if the database doesn't cooperate, you have a problem. And that's what you get then. Windows is painting some snow over your application and you're not making any progress. And really, you know, I asked the Windows team, if it's a managed application, not responding should be waiting for move next. But they didn't buy that, so we're still stuck with this dialogue. But that's what you get if you don't cooperate. So we want to solve this problem, and we said, let's take a look at IEnumerable. What's wrong with it? And how can we sort of make things better? Now, my manager is Dutch, and we all know the Dutch are cheap, and we talk about that all the time. And so the way we actually went about this is by looking at something beautiful from mathematics, and that's the only mathematics I'm going to show today. It's called duality. And what duality means is that you buy one and you get one for free. So, like, who has done some electricity in university? Exactly. So who knows, you know, all the equations for current and voltage and all of that stuff for inductors? Nobody. Okay, that's getting kind of, you know, a shame here. Okay. So inductors and capacitors. Now, those two things have complicated equations, but those equations are very similar. Like, if you know one, you can infer the other one. More specifically, if you go to the exam, you just choose which one you will print on a little piece of paper. You remember how to go from one to the other, and you don't have to memorize both of them. You just learn one, and then you switch a couple of things around. Voltage becomes current, current becomes voltage, blah, blah. Integral here, differential there. And, you know, it just works, you know? It's magical. Same for logic. I invite you to go to the streets of Vienna, find a three-year-old, and actually ask what the difference is between those two formulas. Every three-year-old can tell you. He or she will say, the birds here are flying upwards, and here the bird is flying downwards. Like, the birds are just switched around. It's very simple. Like, if I remember this one, I will automatically be able to infer that one. So, very cheap. You just remember one. Why don't we do this in programming? That's our main question. Why don't we take this beautiful theory, mathematical duality, and apply it to programming? I always kid, you know, about my stuff I did in WPF, and, you know, if I want to tease those people, I'm asking them, what's the dual to a button? Maybe that's the next generation UI framework that you will find there for free. Nobody has thought about it, so, you know, maybe we should do it more. So that's what you get. Buy one, get one for free. But we've already bought one. We already have IEnumerable. It's damn ugly because you can get stuck. So the dual should maybe be something where you don't get stuck. Let's try it. So how do we do dualization? You go to the cookbook for mathematicians, which is called Wikipedia, and you look up dual, category theory, and it says, the dual of a statement is formed by reversing arrows and compositions. Whoa, that's beautiful, that's simple. Reversing arrows means that you're switching input and output positions of methods. That's really what it means. And if you do that, maybe there is some low-hanging fruit to be harvested there. So we're going to try to make this U-turn in synchrony, and hopefully we end up in asynchrony. Good? Like, it seems like voodoo, right? You know, we always wear those weird dresses that people, you know, in the old ages wore, and that were, you know, the people that were healing other people. Like, that's what we wear when we're trying to do this stuff, you know, and people say, those people are crazy. But, you know, it just works. So, fasten your seatbelts. First of all, let's make this whole thing simpler and more explicit. Everyone who's written C knows that, you know, there's open-close parentheses, you can put void there. You know, it's a method that doesn't take in anything, so why don't you just put void there? Same for move next. Beautiful. Properties, some platforms do not believe in properties, and indeed they compile in two methods, so a get-only property is getCurrent, which takes in void. So we're just sort of getting rid of some fluff here, including this reset thing. Don't get me started on that one. Okay, so we got rid of that. But move next is actually not completely honest. It doesn't tell you what it returns. It says, I'm going to give you a Boolean. And it says, you know, implicitly, in the white space in your editor, it says, and I might throw an exception, hoo-hoo. So you don't know that, but in some languages you can write that. In C#, they decided not to borrow this feature for good reasons. So that's what we get. So that's the real interface. Okay, good. Let's continue. An IEnumerator is also IDisposable. What does that mean? That means that when you're no longer interested in the database giving you results, you can say, dispose, not interested anymore. And that also happens when you break out of a for each loop. But what you really have here is a naked IEnumerator, which isn't IDisposable. And when you call getEnumerator, you get both back. Okay? It's sort of the same, like, if you say this thing implements IDisposable, or you would have the capability, this is hypothetical syntax, by the way, we like to do that in those kind of things, you can really say, you know, when you call getEnumerator, you get some way to say shut up, and you get some way to say give me more. So that's actually how you could sort of go about this. So that's what we get. Now, what we want to do is, this IDisposable thing doesn't have to do anything with synchronous versus asynchronous, right? It's just to say, I don't want more data. So ignore that one. We will just dualize the synchrony aspect. How do we do so? Well, we looked at Wikipedia and it said reverse those two things. Input becomes output, output becomes input. So let's do that. You know, I don't care about pixels, but who in PowerPoint animations? I'm just working on them the whole night. So that's what you get here. The void goes to the left, the IEnumerator goes to the right. And void doesn't mean anything. That's just, you know, can have some beautiful mathematical theorems about that. And getEnumerator becomes setEnumerator. I'm no longer getting it, I'm receiving it somehow. You know, that comes in. I will explain later what this means. Because at this point, it's just mechanics, you know. I'm not interpreting the meaning of this whole thing, I'm just doing this exercise, you know. And I invite you to do this exercise on, say, system.string. And, you know, have lots of fun, might take several hours, and then you might end up with something that's useful. I don't know, but maybe. But in this case, it turned out to be useful, otherwise I wouldn't be here, right? So let's take a look at IEnumerator. This guy can throw an exception and can return a Boolean. You know, languages are weird, you know. The language that has this syntax is very weird, because it says it's output in two different places. It says there is an output on the left, you know, Boolean, and then another output type appears all the way on the right. You know, like, why is that? In functional languages, everything is on the same side. And the output is on the right and the input on the left. But, okay. Let's make this a little bit more consistent. Let's say, when you call move next, you get a Boolean or an exception. Again, hypothetical syntax. Beautiful. But let's go a little bit further. If you get a Boolean, what does the contract of IEnumerator say? If I return a true, then you can get the current value. You just do get current. If I give you a false, I'm not giving you anything of data, you know? I'm at the end of a thing. There's nothing moving next. So we can expand a couple of things. This Boolean is really, you get either true or false or an exception. Let's go one step further. If you get a true, then you really got the data. It's just one distance away, right? You have to do one additional operation to get to the data. So we can actually fold it into that same signature. We can say, well, either you get a value of type T, or you get false, or you get an exception. So I'm just simplifying this thing. Beautiful. And finally, if you get false, you really got nothing. And we already have a type for nothing, it's called void. So, what we have is this. This is really how IEnumerator should look like. Now, maybe not, because people will scratch their hair, but, you know, that's what we think it should be. But it's damn easy now to do the dualization. We just switch input and output around. Okay? So we just swap that thing. We don't move next anymore. We're not saying, go to the next thing. No, somebody is saying, I'm at the next thing. Do something. So we got next. Okay. Beautiful. So far, it's all been, you know, voodoo. Now, let's make it a little bit more C-sharpy. We don't have this OR syntax. This means you get either a T or a void or an exception. We can't encode that in C-sharp. Well, we could if we create some wrapper type and so forth. But in reality, this is the same as having three methods. The method gotT is called when you get a value, gotException is called by something in the cloud when you get an exception, and gotNothing is called when we're at the end. So it's beautiful. We have the whole thing. We did the exercise just through Wikipedia. So everyone can do it. It's democratic. And finally, we consult this book, The Design Patterns. Who has this book? Okay, throw it away, and I will tell you why. This book is just unbelievable. At the end, you know, or the last page, the inner page, it has, you know, all sorts of arrows between patterns, like this pattern is related to that one. Well, that's beautiful, but IEnumerable and IEnumerator and observable and IObservable, they're two patterns, don't have a single arrow between the two. If they're not related, even Wikipedia knows it, then that book should be, you know, taken out of the bookshelves, right? Like, if it doesn't see that, then there is a problem. So we used it for one thing, though. We used it to give it names, you know? Like, so we used the design patterns and we saw, hey, this dual thing is IObservable, IObserver. Some other platforms have the same thing, but they are very stateful. They have add listener, remove listener. Oops, did I say listener? That might reveal what platform I'm talking about. And finally, we put the C-sharp 4.0 annotations back. And now this output thing became an input thing, because T is now appearing in input positions. So really, we made some swap, which is kind of expected. Now, this disposable, I will talk about that in just a second, is to detach what's called the observer. And I will show that in code. Don't worry. And finally, that's actually what took the longest. You just go to a building in Redmond called Building 41, where people are sitting that do the BCL, the base class libraries. And those people like to debate names. So they take a couple of months to actually give right names to methods. So we went there and we got the method names. And they say you should go with subscribe, on next, on error, and on completed. We had different names, and maybe they weren't right. We had something like yield, throw, and done. Why is that? Well, I will actually show you later. But so now if you look, it's a push-based interface. The data gets pushed at you. You're not on your bare knees anymore trying to get it out. Now it's just thrown at you. You're sitting in your comfortable chair, and you get some T value. Catch it and do something. So the output is different, but now you can get flooded, and the jewel of getting stuck is getting too much, right? So even English agrees here. So we have this beautiful interface. Let's summarize it. And then let's take a look at it more closely. You have your application, you have the environment, very appropriately drawn as a cloud, and you have two ways of acquiring data. One is interactive, where you are pulling things out. This is the thing you get at the butcher shop or, you know, the postal office, where you have to pull something out of that thing to get the next number for the ticket in line. And so you call move next, and you're just asking, do you have a next value? You might get stuck in doing so. But then, ultimately, you're pulling data into your application. The opposite is reactive, where you basically have the environment tell you at some point, using events or something, lightning bolts, I have the next value, and it sort of just pushes it at you. And so in that world, it's push-based, because the environment is pushing data at you. You're no longer pulling it in, you're just getting it pushed at you. Okay, let's show the interface. Beautiful. Oops. Okay. So I will just create a new project. Having been on WPF, I like to use console applications. That's just, you know, personal, because I don't like any pixels. I just want a low signal-to-noise ratio here. Or a high. Well, something. And I will add a couple of references. Let me point out a couple of things. First of all, I don't need any references in .NET 4 to use system.iobservable. I will prove that to you. I don't have anything weird here. Well, there are some things that are weird, but that's beyond our control. And so let's do iObservable. And you see, system.iObservable is in, defines a provider for push-based notification. That's the text that the BCL team actually took some time for. And we have iObserver, provides a mechanism for receiving push-based notifications. I sort of have to say I like it. So that's what you get by default in .NET 4. Now, the interesting thing is, say that I have an iObservable of int. I'm not going to talk about how to get those yet. I will show that in just a second. The only thing you can do is what's on the slides. You can do subscribe. That's the only thing. And when you do subscribe, you have to give it an iObserver. And so when this iObservable is saying, I have the next value, it's going to notify you on the iObserver you give it. And then you're going to be called on onNext, onError, onCompleted. So that's the way you can actually do this thing. But that's just, you know, way too much work. So that's where the reactive extensions come in. So the interfaces are in the BCL. The reactive extensions are a separate download at this point. And so it consists of two DLLs, system.coreact, I will explain what that one is, and system.reactive. So those two are the ones you need. I will also import system drawing and Windows forms, which give me some UI framework I'm pretty versed at to do some small demos. Okay? So let's import that. One more thing, the interfaces are in the BCL, and that was kind of an interesting exercise as well. Because you go to the BCL team and they say, why do you put interfaces in if nobody is implementing them yet? And we say, if we don't put them in, who's going to implement them? So we said, let's just put them in, and then, you know, people can start implementing them, and the ball is sort of rolling, right? You know, so .NET 4 is the bootstrapping for reactive. We put the interfaces in, and now we're sort of putting things on top of that. And now, I will do iObservable of int axis, axis dot, and who? Just importing those things imports, you know, like 100 methods. And that's what the reactive extensions are, composition over those guys. Now, let's go back to the slides and sort of start introducing that part. Okay. How do you get your observables? You know, that's kind of a very existential question. So, there are a couple of answers to that. We have primitive constructors, which are just factory methods. Now, how is this slide built? On the left, you see what you call in iObservable land, and on the right, you see the corresponding ienumerable. Because those two are dual, you should always think about, how would I do this if I was thinking about ienumerables? And one ienumerable is an array. So observable.empty, when you subscribe to that thing, it immediately says, I'm at the end, uncompleted, there is nothing to follow. That's the same as iterating over an empty array. You do move next and move next as false. Well, move next equals false is the same as uncompleted by means of our duality. So those two things are exactly the same. Just the way that you retrieve data is different. Observable return is like a single cell array. It gives you the value by calling onNext. Here's the next value for you. And then it says onCompleted. Those are called marble diagrams. So the marbles indicate onNext calls. The vertical bar is onCompleted. I didn't put onCompleted on this line because we already know how they look. Those are the vertical bars. Observable.throw. It's something, when you subscribe, it immediately says, hey, there is an error for you. Okay, useful. Those are the basic elements. In C#, you could write that by creating a method that returns an ienumerable, doing yield, break, and throw exception somewhere. And then you get an iterator. When you call move next, that exception comes out. So you can do exactly the same in the other world. And we also have observable.never. Well, that's a beautiful one. Observable.never is, you can subscribe as many times as you want. It won't ever tell you anything. It's just, you know, dead on the ground, not doing anything. Well, that's beautiful. Why is that beautiful? Because in the observable world, you don't have to waste any CPU cycles or any resources to do so. This is just something that returns an iObservable that ignores subscription. Now, if you do enumerable.never, well, you do move next. What should move next do for enumerable.never? It should never return. What does that mean? That your whole thread is stuck. So you're sacrificing a single thread to be stuck in the pool-based world. In the asynchronous world, you don't have to spend any resources to get stuck. Isn't that beautiful? Like, so the duality really holds. If those things actually work, then it's great. Now let's get to the serious stuff, because this is just toys, you know, that's academics. Here's another example, enumerable.range and observable.range. And here you see the grammar of observables. You can have any number of onNext calls followed by an onError or an onComplete. You can also have an infinite number of onNext, and then you don't get any of those. But if you get an error, you can't get anything more. That's like exceptions in the CLR. After an exception, your stack is unwound, and you don't get anything more. Unlike Windows PowerShell, where you have onNext or onError any number of times, and then onCompleted. Kind of just interesting to know. So if you look at this, in enumerable.range, you would write this by doing yield return, yield return, yield return. That's the syntax you would use to write enumerable.range to implement that method. You would use iterators in observable.range. You call onNext, onNext, onNext. So that's the reason why we wanted to call the onNext method yield at some point. But that conflicts with keywords in some languages. Okay, another function, a generator function. That's even more beautiful. So we're getting to the more useful stuff now. On the right, I have hypothetical syntax again for C#, allowing you to create an IEnumerable without declaring a method and doing yield return inside. You can do that, you just have to put it in separate methods. You can't do new IEnumerable. And so I'm just doing for blah, 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 yield return the squares. Okay, that returns 0, 1, 4, and so forth. And I do for each over there. In our world, we don't have language integrated syntax yet. So you do observable.generate, and you use lambda expressions. You say the stopping condition is if I is lower than 10. Iteration is I one further. Returning values is I times I. So it's exactly the same. If you squint, it's exactly the same code. Now the core difference, of course, is the way it works. Here I do subscribe. And as soon as I do subscribe, my main thread that's calling subscribe just moves on. It goes over here. If you do F10 on that thing, you end up here. Like, it's asynchronous. You can do subscribe and then do something else. Here, you do for each, and it doesn't return, go beyond this curly brace until you've drained the whole sequence. So this is synchronous. You have to spend resources getting the data out. So that's actually the difference. Now, we also have a variant, generate with time, where you can actually create an observable sequence that returns values with certain time spans between them. So, create I will actually skip. It's more of academic interest, but we have something called observable create, which is the replacement of implementing the interface yourself. Like, for every interface we introduce, we create a static create method. That means that you never have to implement the interface, you can simply use a method. And same for observable.subscribe. Normally you have to pass in an iObserver here. Well, we also give you overloads that take in onNext, onError, and onCompleted. And this syntax is actually C# 4.0 named parameter syntax. So it even looks like you're implementing the thing in line in some sense, right? You can really see the method names over there. Okay, so actually, when this thing executes, I just want to emphasize one thing. So this is like in Visual Studio. You're pressing F5 or F10. You start executing. You set a breakpoint in the onNext handler of the observable. And now you press F5. At this point, it's asynchronous. You return immediately. So your main thread can do something else, such as the very useful activity of sleeping. So it can actually sleep for 30 seconds. And while your main thread is doing that sleep, oops, that breakpoint is hitting on a different thread. So the observable is running somewhere else. And all of a sudden, it says, hey, I got 42 for you. And you end up here. So that's something you should be prepared to see in this kind of code. That's where you have, you know, two threads in the same method body. One is sitting there, one is sitting there. That can just happen. So that's how it looks. Let's show how to get an observable. Okay. So how do I get an observable? First rule, never implement the interface. You should almost never have to implement the interface yourself. So I will create an observable by doing observable dot, and let's, for example, do generate with time. So, what does generate with time want from me? First of all, some initial state. It's just a for loop. Just remember it's a for loop. Let's say the initial state is 0. Then it wants a condition to say, when should I stop? Let's actually say, I don't care about the current value, like, you know, the current I, for int I equals blah blah, and I'm always going to return false. That means this is an infinite sequence. It will never say uncompleted or on error, unless I do something silly somewhere else that throws an exception. Next, what's the iteration function? Let's say I just want to go from I to I plus 1. Just go to the next value. What's the result selector? Given that I value, what do you want me to return? I will say, well, let's return I goes to a new string, which has, I believe there is an overload that takes in an asterisk and then a count. So let's say I just want asterisks. One asterisk, then two asterisks, then three asterisks, and so forth. So now I have an I observable that returns asterisks. And finally, for the given I, how long do you want me to wait before I produce that value to all the subscribers? So that's actually some delay. So I can do I dot time span from seconds of I. So the first one will take 0 seconds, the second one 1 second, 2 seconds, and it will always get slower. Not very useful to make an application that always slows down, but, you know, why not? We can do it. So let's see. Oops. Cannot convert iObservable of string to iObservable of int. That's true, because I'm returning an iObservable that returns strings. That was that third lambda expression, and why am I actually bothering to write this? Let's just use type inference. All our code in Rx, and not start the help agent, all the code in Rx is all, you know, vars, you know, a soup of vars, you know, beautiful to look at. Good. So now let's actually subscribe. As I said before, the master overload, which is in my slides, takes in an iObserver. But you can also use the overloads, the extension methods, that take in actions. So I can give it a delegate here that says, this is my onNext handler. This is onError, this is uncompleted. So I can do x goes to console write line x. And let's not care about onError and uncompleted. If you don't want to handle those, yeah, just ignore them. So that's all you get here. I could actually get rid of x goes to and so forth. You know, in C-sharp you can just do delegates by, you know, passing in a method group. So this means subscribe, and when there is a next value, the console write line of that value. Okay? What does this thing return? That thing returns an iDisposable. Well, that's beautiful. I can use the using statement if I really want. So let's do the using statement. This means it will dispose as soon as we leave this block. And I will do console write line, press enter to stop, and then I will do console read line. So that means that that subscription is active until I actually press enter, then I will leave the using block and it will dispose the subscription. And in the meantime, this thing can go. It's going on a different thread. So as long as I don't press enter, this thing should actually print stuff. Sometimes. What have I done wrong? Help. That's interesting. False. Oh, the condition should be true to continue, not false. You know, primitive Boolean logic is not my strongest point. Okay. So, you see, it takes 3 seconds, now 4 seconds. Come on, 4 seconds. Now 5 seconds, and so forth. So it's producing strings, they are thrown at me, and in the meantime, I'm not blocked, you know, I can type here, and I can press enter. And then the subscription is gone, my application has also quit, it turns out, because I'm at the end of my main method. But as you can see, I was still active while that thing was going, so it's asynchronous. Okay, very beautiful, let's continue. Now, the useful stuff. We've only been playing so far. We've been creating toys, you know, like little turtles moving on the floor. Now, what I want to do is I want to use .NET events, which are a source of asynchronous programming, and bridge them to Rx. Now, why should I do that? First of all, you should not always do it. .NET events are useful. But in certain cases, they break down pretty quickly. Over here, mouse move plus equals blah, blah, blah. First of all, when you look at this code, it's a hidden data source. Nobody thinks of your mouse as a database of points. Like, you know, they look at you and they lock you up somewhere if you say that. A mouse is a database of points. But they are hidden in the event arguments. You have to dot into that, do dot location, dot x, and so forth. Like, nobody thinks of them as data sources. Secondly, a .NET event is darn useful, but you can't pass it to anyone. Say that you have some service that says, you know, I'm a GPS map rendering service, and the only thing I want from you is a reactive data source of points. You say, I want to mock this thing up using mouse moves. If I move my mouse over a map, I should see that GPS thing working. But you can't grab .mouseMove and just stick it in an object and give it to someone. It's ungrabbable. Like, it's not a first-class .NET citizen. It's some metadata thing, but you can't grab it. You can't assign it in a field, put it in an array, whatever. That's a problem. There's also lack of composition. You can't go to the streets here and say, I want a smart mathematician that implements a filter that works over any .NET event. They can't give you that. They can't give you filter. They will say, you will have to create an event handler and just put an if statement in there, which opens the door for all sorts of imperative code here. Like, nobody sees anymore at first glance, well, this is mouse moves, but filtered somehow. Like, and also, when you do that filter, you don't have an event anymore. You're in imperative land. You know, you sort of have to write code and continue writing code. Like, you can't do plus equals on a filtered mouse move anymore. And finally, resource maintenance is also painful. In order to do minus equals, you have to remember what you gave to plus equals. You have to store it in a field to be able to do minus equals. Just don't copy-paste that whole code. That won't work, because it are two different delegates. But like, you have to store that thing somewhere. Ah, it gets all painful. So in Rx, instead, you write this. You say observable from event of mouse move events, and that returns an iObservable of points. In reality, it returns a little bit more, and I will show that in a second. But now, when you look at the signature, or even just look at the type, you see, hey, mouse moves is a database of points. If I subscribe, I will get points. Beautiful. Secondly, you can pass those objects around. If a GPS sensor says, I want an iObservable of point, it can just ask for one, and you can give the mouse moves to it, and yeah, just play with it. Like, you can pass them around. They are just objects. Third, we can define operators once and for all for you. You don't have to do subscribe on next if the position equals blah, blah. No, you just say dot where. So now you have a query over mouse moves that only triggers when the mouse is on the first bisector where x and y are the same. And finally, if you say, I'm no longer interested in you giving me stuff, you've done a subscribe at some point, you forget about what you gave the subscribe, but you can still just call this post to say, I don't care anymore. So you don't have to do all of that state maintenance yourself. Second one, I've shown you how to bridge with .NET events. I'm going to show it in a demo in just a second. Asynchronous methods in .NET, exactly the same problem. First of all, if you look at all of this code, who will say that, you know, the file stream begin and entry is a data source of byte arrays? Nobody. It's just hidden somewhere in signatures. Like, you don't really see that. Like, if you look at begin read, it takes in two ints and a byte array and it returns, well, just way too complicated. Secondly, you can't pass them around. Like, how are you going to say somebody wants an iObservable of byte arrays? Well, you have to wrap begin read and end read in a tuple of delegates and give that to someone and say you have to call it this way. That doesn't work. Again, no composition. Say if I want to, you know, I don't know, decode using Unicode my byte array. I no longer have now an asynchronous method pair that returns strings. No, I have to write imperative code here. Like, you don't have composition. You have an observable, or in this case, asynchronous methods, and you fall off the ship immediately. Like, you know, you have to write code here. And finally, all sorts of wacky things. What if an exception happens? I don't even know how to do that. When this thing synchronously completes, we have that null weird thing that you have to pass everywhere to asynchronous methods because they were invented before C# 2.0 had closures. So it becomes all way too complicated. So in iObservable land, we say, import this whole thing and make it an iObservable. So we do observable from async pattern. You have to give it quite some types just to tell us what the signature is. And you give it the pair of begin and end read methods. Now what you got is a function that if you give it a byte array and two ints, it will actually return an observable that returns the number of bytes that were actually written to that particular byte array. And now you can start composing. It only takes like one method call to make this in an iObservable of byte arrays. It's really very simple to, you know, start playing with those guys from this point on. So I'll leave that as an exercise. I will actually show it in the demo in just a second. So what's the big message? We don't replace those things. We're not knocking on the CLR door and saying, get rid of events, substitute them with iObservables. They're not going to buy that because you have heap allocation, blah, blah, blah. So we're not replacing those because they are still darn useful, but they break down as soon as you start composing. If you just have a button click event, go for it. That's simple. But once you have two buttons and you want to do something when the two buttons are clicked simultaneously, I don't know how you would do that. But you know, if you want to do something like that, you have to, you know, compose, and that doesn't work with classic .NET events. So then you go to Rx. Same for asynchronous methods. They're totally fine, maybe a little clumsy. But if you want to do more, then go to Rx. And similarly, if you look at the whole Microsoft ecosystem, there are tons of things that are push-based. We have wrappers for PowerShell, wrappers for WMI, wrappers for SQL integration services. All of those things can be just summarized as it's an iObservable in some server product. You know, that's what it is. So what we do, we unify that by means of one type. We introduce some stuff, operators, and so forth. So we build bridges. Terminology I will actually skip because I want to show a demo, which is far more compelling. So let's comment out code. That's also the way our code base evolves. We never delete stuff. Okay, I'm just kidding, by the way. You know, that's Belgian sarcastic humor. Okay, so let's create a new form using WinForms. Okay, application run form. So I have a form at this point, you know. We'll just show up, there it is. Beautiful. Now, what I want to do is I want to put a text box on this thing and start playing with it. So let's add a text box. You don't need designers, you just use C# JSON style. Controls equals TXT. This just works in C# 3.0. Now I have a text box on a form. So who needs designers? You just write all of this crap. Okay, good. So what do I want to do right now? I want to listen to the text changed events. Be prepared to be amazed. Okay, txt.textchanged. I'm the user just using this thing for the very first time. And I'm here, looking at text changed. Where's the text that has changed? Okay, maybe it's an E. Let's do E dot. No text here. There's no damn way to get the text out of this event. You have to go to the sender, cast it back to a text box, do dot text. It's not a data source of strings even. So how do we go about making this better? Let's show this in code. So instead of doing event handlers, I want to use Rx. So I'm going to start with doing observable from event. And I have to pass in the event arguments type here, just to tell us everything we need. And we say, listen to the text box, event name text change. This uses reflection. We also have an overload where you can pass in two delegates. It's much, much more typing. So I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to be lazy and use some reflection here. Now, what I get here is var ts, which is the texts. And this is an iObservable of iEvent of event args. That's how we surface a .NET event in Rx. What does that mean? Well, if I do ts.subscribe, I can do something like, you know, the event goes to console write line. So this is my handler, e dot, hey, I see the event args and the sender. It's not any better at this point than, you know, just an event handler, which also had those two things in it. It's statically typed, though. If I would put mouse event args in there, my event args here would be of that type. So that's beautiful, but it's not very useful yet. So how do I change the representation of something in a database? You use projection or select. So now let's do var result equals from some input in the text box, select, let's actually do from e, you know, e.sender, cast it to a text box. You still have to do that. You know, we can't, you know, give you snake oil. And you return the text. But at this point, what you have is an iObservable of string. Okay? Now you have an iObservable. So we went from an iObservable to another iObservable through projection using the select keyword. And now if I subscribe to this thing, result.subscribe, console write line, like this, and I'm even not bothering, well, let's bother just, you know, for good measures, you know, like this. If the application quits, I want to unsubscribe, you know, just be a good citizen. It's going to die anyway, but, you know, yeah. Let's give the CLR a little bit more work before it kills the process. Okay, and now what we have is, if I start typing here, I have an event handler. Okay, it's just working. But I've just imported the thing now by doing something more. More specifically, what I've done is I've taken an iObservable of iEvents and projected them into an iObservable of string. So now the power is starting to feel. Okay, let's continue. A little bit more. What's asynchrony? I've talked about that. It means that two things can run independently of each other. Okay? So why is that important? Because we have one single notion in Rx that's actually used to do concurrency. Like, we don't want to be in the act of creating task pools and thread pools and all of that stuff. We say whenever Rx needs to introduce concurrency, because things need to go in parallel, we use this thing called an iScheduler. And the whole Rx assembly, system.reactive, doesn't contain a single word about threading, TPL, or anything. It always goes into system.coreact, which has iSchedulers that are used to introduce concurrency. So in this particular case, observable.return, all of those methods are parameterized with an optional iScheduler. And there you can say where we should do the work. Now, not going too much into this, but I'm going into something else in just a second where this thing becomes useful. A golden rule is if you see an iScheduler in your code, most likely you don't need it because our defaults make sense. But in some cases, if you need them, we give you the flexibility to use them. Does duality apply in the world of concurrency? I have two pieces of code here. This is very important. Here you can convert between an enumerable and an observable and the opposite direction. Why is that important? Unit testing. How do you test a user interface with lots of logic after behind the mouse move event? You mock the mouse move event. How do you do so today? Oh my goodness, I need to, you know, change that code and that event handler needs to be taken out. And you can't just substitute that thing. In our world, you say, hey, mouse moves is an iObservable of point. To unit test this thing, I'm just going to give it an other iObservable of point. More specifically, I could create an array of points, which are all the coordinates where the mouse virtually goes, and then do two observable. So now you have a whole test of inputs, and then you do two observable, and you feed it into your logic. And your logic is just working on a different iObservable. No longer the observable coming from the eventing system, but from somewhere else. So observables and enumerables can go in both ways. What's the interesting thing here? From an enumerable to go to an observable, we need to introduce concurrency. Because something in the background needs to pull that enumerable and it can get stuck, but you subscribing to the observable should never get stuck. So to go that direction, we need to introduce concurrency. To do that work of pulling things out and then signaling it to you. The opposite way, going from an observable to an enumerable, we have to take away concurrency. We have to sit there, wait for the next things to come in, and then tunnel them out in one thread which is, you know, being pulling at you. So the duality holds here, because in one case we have to add it, in the other case we have to remove it. And so we have lots of operators that just are intrinsically based on this asynchrony model. Like, for example, we have an operator called AMP. AMP stands for ambiguous, it comes from functional programming. The interesting thing of ambiguous is that McCarthy introduced that in the 60s or the 50s even, in Ski and Lisp and all of those guys. And the reason he introduced it, I'm just kidding here by the way, he introduced it because he was just bored with his programs. They were deterministic. For God's sake, every time I passed in the same input to my functional program, it returned the same output. Well, that's not challenging. Once I run it once, I can throw away the program and substitute it with a constant. So he said, that's not interesting, I want AMP. And AMP is ambiguous. That means one time it's going to choose the left one, the other time it's going to choose the right one. And if you do 10 of those AMP things in your code, well, your code gets very exciting. Every time you run it, ooh, something else happens. So we say that's useful as well. Why is that useful? Say you have two stock tickers in the cloud. iObservable of stock quote. And now you want to have those two sources race for each other. Like, I want to get the stock quote of Microsoft right now, as soon as possible, and I will pay for 5 stock tickers. What you do is you have the 5 stock tickers, you do .amp between them, and then we let them race in parallel. They are going, and all of a sudden one of those guys says, I have a value for you. What do we do at that point? We unsubscribe all the other ones and give the value to you. So we are introducing concurrency for all those things to go in parallel. We have all the logic to cancel out as soon as one says, I have a value, and then that one is the winner. That's the most reliable stock ticker because it was the fastest to give me results, so I will go for the rest of ages with that one. Of course, you can do other things as well, but it shows this racing thing. Those two sources are racing, and a car race isn't run by chaining the wheels together, right? They need to move independently, those cars, so we need concurrency. And so that's why certain operators rely on concurrency. Other sample. This sample is beautiful. Well, not so beautiful, it turns out. I do observable return 42 on the thread pool. What does that do? Well, it will call on next somewhere on a background thread. Now, if I subscribe to that thing and bind it to the UI, what do you get in WinForms? You're not doing this on the UI thread, silly you, and you get this exception. That's not beautiful. How can we solve that problem? Hey, we have the iScheduler notion. We can do composition for that. You don't have to write anything like form.invoke with a lambda. No, you just say, access is ill-behaved. It doesn't go on the right thread when it has values. But I want to see the values on a different thread. You say .observeOn, you give it the form, and we'll do the synchronization for you. So at this point, the code is just working. What was the signal-to-noise ratio here? Well, you just had to put in observeOn. You don't have to throw away all of your code and, you know, inject some lambda functions. You can just do observeOn, and we do the synchronization for you. And the master overload takes in a nice scheduler. So here I have some other examples. I'm actually going back to the demo in just a second. But so here I'm showing what I did with the text box, but for mouse moves. So I'm doing mouse moves, and I'm using selection to project out only the location. So that's the select operator. Going from an iObservable of iEvent of mouse event args, I'm going to an iObservable of points. So I'm just using selection, like projection from one thing to the other. And then to write a filter so that the mouse moves only are triggered whenever I'm on the first bisector of the form, I can use a where class. So I can use all of the link primitives just, you know, to do asynchronous stuff here. Okay, putting the pieces together, that's what I want to build. Watch carefully. The user types something in my much-beloved text box. The text has changed, and we made it into an iObservable of string. I did that before. Now my demo is going to build up. What I want to do with this is I want to go to a web service to ask asynchronously for all the words that start with React. Okay? Now, every asynchronous request costs money, because this is a paying web service. So I want to reduce the number of calls to the web service. We are going to save you money. Now everyone is waking up. Beautiful. So, and what I want to get back after this whole composition is asynchronously, I want to get back dictionary word arrays, which corresponds to React, and I will bind them to the UI in some list box. Okay, beautiful. Now, I'm not going to show this slide yet. I'm first going to do the money-saving part. Okay, I have a text box. This is all working. Let me show a couple of things. First of all, I'm typing reactive. That's beautiful. I get events. Now I'm doing something silly. I know how UI frameworks work, so it's not that hard to find out for me. So I do shift left to select the E, and now I'm a user typing an E. Hey, the text has changed. It hasn't changed. It's still the same text, but the UI framework thinks it has changed because all of the state has been invalidated, you know, like the little pixies and elves were working in the framework, and oops, the thing has changed. It didn't change. How do I filter that out? Because this is going to cost me a dollar, this is going to cost me another dollar or a euro. So I don't want those duplicates. How do you do that with regular .NET events? You have a field with the last value. If the value is not the same as the last value, then do this, otherwise do that. Lots of state. You know, you have to keep state and fields. Oh my goodness. How do I fix this thing? Well, we have operators, it turns out. We have an operator called distinct until changed. What does that do? It remembers the last value. If the value is not the same, it... Okay. But it's compositional. You didn't have to write a damn line of code. So I type reactive, I change the E with an E. Ooh, that's beautiful. Okay, I've saved money. But I'm a pretty good typer. I'm not a pretty good typer. I type with two fingers. Don't look. But so, I could type this thing really fast. Is the user interested in downloading the whole dictionary that starts with an R? Then 1 millisecond later, he has changed his mind. Oh, I only want RE. 1 second later, or millisecond later, he wants only RIA, and so forth. No. The user is just typing the thing, but I don't want to go to the web service all the time. No, I want the user to calm down, relax, get a cup of coffee, and then I will go to the web service behind his back. So I want to throttle the input. I want to say it should take at least 500 milliseconds of no user input before we do the call. Okay, how do you do that in .NET events? Ah, very simple. You have an event handler. You start the timer. You cancel the previous timers. If the timer goes out, you remember the last value. You should overwrite last value every time a new value comes in. Okay, doesn't work. So, way too difficult. In our world, we do throttle of time span from seconds, half a second. Beautiful. Okay. Reactive. I wait half a second. Oops, there it is. So we do the timer cancellation, blah, 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 all of that stuff. So this is a pretty well-behaved application. You can continue typing here without ever going to the web service, so you can give it to your children that are 3 years old. You know, they won't cost you money. They already cost you money enough. So beautiful. They can just bang on the keyboard if they're fast enough. Okay. So I have a countdown event source. Now I want to go to the web service. Let's actually go back to the slides to show how that works. So here we go. I have distinct throttle, blah, blah. And I will have to do a little bit more of code, and I'm going to show this just now. I will do an asynchronous web service proxy, which I will import using from async pattern. Okay? Let's actually cancel the slide again and do this first. Okay? Because the grand composition is really too good to be seen at this point. Okay. Let's add a service reference. I do have a web service. Okay. This is the web service. And it has a thing called matchindict, which I can give three things. The dictionary, which is WordNet. That's the one I'm going to use, some voodoo here. All the words that start with React, and the strategy will be prefix. I want everything that starts with React. Okay? That thing will have to come from the user input. The other things are constant. Okay? If I press invoke, I will get the dictionary for all the things that start with React. Beautiful. So let's import that thing. And since we're asynchronous, I want to have asynchronous methods. Okay? So I'm just telling WCF, please go and generate some fluffy code. Okay, takes a second. Okay, so while that's going, the action plan here will be to do observable from asynchronous event. Once I have that, I will have a function that takes in those three inputs to the web service and returns an iObservable of dictionary word arrays. This thing takes long. And then finally, I want to project, or I want to basically bind that to the UI. Let's actually go to the slides first while this thing is going. If it doesn't work, I actually have it offline in a separate project, so I can always rescue this baby. So how do we do this? Again, we write a query. When the user has typed something in a countdown fashion, you know, every second or half a second, doesn't matter, I want to, so from every term that the user has written, I want to call my lookup function, which is my web service call, here, lookup of term, and I'm basically doing a join between a text box and an online dictionary. I'm doing from the input in the text box, from the results of my web service call, return the results of the web service call. That's what you would write in SQL if you have two tables. One table is the database of, you know, the text box. The other one is the database on a server. And this whole thing is still asynchronous, because when I subscribe to this thing, what do we do for you? We subscribe to the input. When the input comes out, we call this function. Then we wait for that function to complete or to send data, and then we tunnel it to you. So the whole thing is still asynchronous. And so this thing actually translates into the select many operator by the C# compiler. So that's what it actually binds to. And so that's the way it works. So that's the demo. And beautiful, it has imported it. You know, never lose faith in WCF nor network connections. Good. So how do I import my service? Dict service soap, blah, blah. I've forgotten how it's called. It's called somewhere. Dict service something. Ah, maybe, yeah. Dict service client. No. Service reference 1 dot dict service. Ah, dict service soap client? Oh, beautiful. Dict service soap client it is. Okay, there we go. Var proxy equals this thing. And if I'm not mistaken, oh, new, I have to pass in, last time I did this at least, I had to point this at dict service soap, which was some endpoint binding because they support XML and JSON and blah, blah, blah on that web service, and I have to do some voodoo here. But now I have a proxy, and I could do proxy.begin match in dict, and then you get all of this, you know, fluff, you know, have to pass in the dictionary, beautiful, the word, beautiful, the strategy, beautiful, an asynchronous callback, an asynchronous state. We don't want any of that, we want Rx to do that for us. So I'm going to do observable.from async pattern. And now, unfortunately, the type inference in C# is not strong enough to infer things from method groups, so I will have to pass in all the parameters myself. But so it takes in a string, which is the dictionary, it takes in a string, which is the word, it takes in a string, which is the strategy, and it returns a dictionary word array. So that's actually the signature of begin and end put together without all the async callback stuff. We don't care about that, we will do that for you. So I still need to pass in the two methods to make the bridge. So I'm going to say proxy.beginMatchIndict, and proxy.endMatchIndict. Beautiful. So there we go. What we have now is a lookup method. If I hover over this, it's a function that takes in my three inputs to the web service and returns an iObservable. Okay? So, I still want to do one thing more, because two things are always fixed, the dictionary and the strategy. I don't want to write it everywhere, so I'm just going to encapsulate that a little bit. Let's just do match, and let's do lookup equals a function that takes in a string and returns a dictionary word array. That's actually what I have on the slides as well. So I'm going to take in the word, and I'm going to call match with WordNet dictionary, then the word to look up, and then the fact I want prefix strategy. So I'm just creating a method, you know, that just encapsulates those two constant values. So now my whole thing looks a little bit better. Well, not quite, because the function doesn't return an array. It returns an iObservable of an array. So given this thing, I could now call this thing naked without, you know, the input. I could say lookup of React and then subscribe to that thing, you know, just without any composition I could do that. And then I will just get at some point in the future the dictionary entries. Okay, now, oh, I have a bracket missing, I have a bracket missing, beautiful. So now I can actually do something more. This result thing, that are not my results I want to render in the UI. Instead, that's my input of the user, right? So that's input, that's what the user wrote, and then my result becomes var results equals from the term written in the input. So that's when the user types something, waiting 500 milliseconds, not wasting money, from words in lookup of that term, select words. What I have now is an iObservable of dictionary word arrays. When I subscribe to that thing, we're listening for the text box. When the text box fires, we actually go to the web service and then tunnel out the output to you. So that's basically the composition we've done for you. And so, again, if you want to do all of that yourself, you're welcome to do so. But that's kind of painful. Now I want to render that somewhere. So I'm going to use my marvelous UI designing skills to create a list box, which actually lives at top equals 20. And I'm going to add that to my UI. I'm not using it yet, but that's how my UI looks, damn sexy. Okay? And now I just want to populate the list box. Let me actually do this. Res subscribe What do I get back now? I get back word arrays corresponding to the last user input. So I'm going to take in the words, and now I'm going to put them on the UI. Now, what's words? That's an array. Okay, so what's my list box? List.items.clear. The first input in the list box needs to go away. And now I want to do list.items.addRange. And I want to add everything from words. But this thing actually needs an object array. I have words, but words actually contain a little bit more. What's a dictionary word, by the way? Oops, that's not what I want. A dictionary word, like this, contains the dictionary in which it was found, but I don't care about that, and the word itself. So I just want to get the word, and I'm just going to use link to objects to project away the dictionary array and just select the word. So let me do that. From word in words, select word.word. That's a lot of words. Okay, so there we go. So I just have too much. I'm just filtering it away this time using link to objects. We didn't invent that. That was already there. Okay. And now let's actually try to run this. Reactive. Wait half a second. And it's going to the web service. The network is kind of slow. Isn't it going? Please. What's it doing? Ah, there we go. Not what I expected, but what's happening is that the web service call came back on a background thread because it's asynchronous, it uses a thread pool. Now, I want to bind to the UI, but I get a cross-thread violation. How do I solve this thing? Oh, no sweat, you know, I just do observe on. Observe on the foreign. Okay, so problem solved, you know, like if you had to do that manually, then it was this.invoke and blah, blah. So in this case, compositional, and I type React, or let's just do React. I've not gone to the web service because I canceled out IVE in a matter of 500 milliseconds. And there we go, there we have, you know, the output of the web service.
Yeah, and I think for this we can really give a big applause.
Okay.
Which is actually not that common in Austrian presentations, but it's really great, great, I think.
Thank you. So let's now actually wrap up. I have the summary slide of what we've done here. Actually, very good timing for that.
Really?
Yes, okay. Actually.
Didn't want to stop you.
No, actually I'm almost done. I just have one more caveat I need to point out, because my code contains a bug. Oh my goodness. Let's actually take a look at this animation. The user types React. Oh, the user has changed his mind and types Reactive. The first service call is going. The second service call is going. Second service call was already done. The UI actually rendered Reactive temporarily. But then the old web service call still came in. There was a race condition on the network. Reactive, all the words that start with Reactive are apparently reaction reactor. The user is frustrated. Oh my goodness. Lots of Ajax applications contain this problem. You're typing, you know, you get auto-completion, and then you wait for a second, oops, some other auto-completion comes back. That's not beautiful. How do we solve this? Now, if you would have found this bug, you know, in classic .NET events and asynchronous methods, oh my goodness, lots of problems, because you have to cancel out outstanding calls. How do you solve it in our case? How do you get rid of the first service call when the second one is starting to work? Again, composition. You just use a single operator. Of course, you have to know which operator to use, but once you know all of the operators, you get very, very versed at all their behavior. You just put in one operator and it will fix it. What's the operator called? It's called take until. So what you really have here is we're taking the horizontal line's output until the vertical line, which is the signal wire, says stop it. So what's this really like? I gave this presentation first 6 months ago, and then there was lots of stuff with oil pipes. This is a blowout preventer on oil pipe. You know, like when the oil is flowing and all of a sudden the thing on the sea actually explodes, then the thing needs to stop. It didn't stop in the Mexican Gulf, but you know, that's basically what we have. It's a blowout preventer that works. So that's take until. How do we apply the fix? We have exactly the same code and we say, from term in the input, whenever the user writes something, we do a lookup on the web service, and we take its results until the user types something new. Take until. and then we tunnel things too. So we do the cancellation for you. Oh, the user did something. The web service call is in flight. We have to mute it, cancel it out, all of that nasty stuff. And you will never see the things that the user or that the original web service call returned. So we do all of that plumbing for you. It's even that common that we have a specialized operator called switch for that. Switch is like a staircase. It takes something until the next one comes. It takes something until the next one comes, and so forth and so forth. So what switch is, it operates on, I think I have it here. I don't have it here. Oh, it's in here. Switch operates on an iObservable of iObservables. Little brain teaser. But you know, the outer one says, a new batch has arrived. The inner one says, here are the results. Outer batch says, a new one has arrived. Here are the results. What switch does is, it looks at the outer one, it listens to the inner one, until a new outer one signals. So the first request comes, I'm listening. Oh, a new batch comes in, cancel out the previous one, listen. Oh, a new one comes in, and so forth. So it's like really a staircase. Take something until, and so forth. And so that's actually the issue. Now, actually the network is slow enough, which is a compliment in this case for this demo, that we actually might see the problem, you know? And actually, to really see the problem, let me be a little bit more naughty here. I need to type really fast. But I want to have two web service calls that are approximately at the same time. Reactive, okay. Ah, fuck. Excuse me. I wasn't quick enough. Reactive, okay, bang. Okay, reactive is going and bang is going. There's reactive. Oh, reactive won. But it could have been that bang won, and then, you know, reactive came, and then the whole thing was out of order. The fix would have been put take until in, and you would not see the problem anymore. Again, if you want to test this, you found that nasty bug in your application, you want to test for it now. What do? Well, you use a scheduler with some virtual time. We have a test scheduler with virtual time, where you basically mimic, you know, the situation of the out-of-order arrival. You just have an array, you know, you say, first I send reactive, and then using some mock, I will return those words. And please take like half a second virtual time. That's always going to work in that order, because we can guarantee that. And then you do bang with those results. You just make them arrive out of order. The test is going to fail. Then you put take until, and the text will always work. And that's the beauty of schedulers. You can even virtualize time. Like, we never start a timer ourselves. We always ask the scheduler, please do something in 200 milliseconds from now. If you virtualize what that means, just by putting it in a queue and just going through the queue, then you will have the causality of all the events in your framework, in your testing framework. So we have a test framework as well. So, that's actually something I want to skip. That doesn't matter. I want to go to the... So what I was just mentioning on that slide, and I will share out the slides, is that we also have the same thing analog to iQueryable. So you can actually have a query expression that the user wrote for asynchronous stuff that translates at runtime in some query sent to a server to execute the thing there. So we have that same thing, and that the sample I actually have of that is linked to WMI events, which is online, and that actually translates the C# query into some specific syntax that's sent to some server. So mission accomplished, I hope. First of all, we made asynchronous and event-based programs a lot simpler. You don't have to worry about cancellation, don't have to worry about error handling, all of that stuff. We have lots of operators that help you do that. We have, for example, operators called catch and finally and, you know, throw and all of that. We have exception handling primitives. You can all just dot it together, like dot next operator, dot next operator, and so forth. Secondly, it's all about composition. If you have two iObservables and you want to create a new one out of that, for example, using take until or whatever, it's very cheap to do so. It's just a matter of adding an operator. Like, the operator is the little dot on the left, you know? It's not something very bold with lots of code. It's very simple. And finally, everything you know of link, where and select and all of that, and that whole mindset of thinking completely carries through to through the iObservable world with Rx, because, you know, we just piggyback on that technology. Like, the select many, just do from keywords. You never have to think how that thing actually works behind the scenes. So you can download it at those locations. My email address is on the first slide. It's a reactive mailbox with an out-of-office message in the OnNext handler currently. But as soon as I'm back, I will actually try to reply. Actually, if you do that, you know, exercise, you send an email, you will get a piece of our Xcode back with take until, you know, and all of that stuff. Yeah, I want to be a little bit geeky there. And so there are a couple of useful resources. We're steaming ahead. We're doing much more stuff, you know, much more operators and much more intelligence in the system. But so you can actually find the downloads on the previous slide. We have two hands-on labs. Actually, the demo I gave here for the dictionary lookup is completely documented in a 35-page document, step by step. That's a hands-on lab for .NET. We have exactly the same thing for JavaScript, so you could have done everything in the browser here with Ajax stuff and web service calls through some magic voodoo of, you know, JSON, REST, blah, blah. And we also have some web presence, particularly watch Channel 9. If you have something big, you know, to talk about, you can actually go to Channel 9 and you will find us, have a video on the new baby that we've actually produced. So with that, if there are questions, I will be around. And I want to thank you for your attention.